Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. Today we'll be talking to Austin Bay and Al Nofi. Austin Bay is an author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Al Nofi is a military analyst, military historian, and author. Al compiles and writes our popular CIC section on the site. Welcome, Austin and Al. Last time we kicked off World War One, and today, talking to you guys, we decided to talk a little bit about strategy and tactics and hardware and technology and leadership and like that during World War One. How did this all play into how the war was going to be fought, Al?
Oh, good one. The standard image of the war is the donkeys, these imbecile generals sitting in their chateaus miles behind the front without a clue about the what was going on and just sending men into frontal attacks again and again and again until finally the body count was so great that one side collapsed in this orgy of attrition. Well, this was an interpretation that came about by guys writing their memoirs immediately at the end of the war. Angry guys for various reasons. But in fact, it's not necessarily true. Beginning as early as the American Civil War, many armies had begun to try and figure out what was happening. Firepower was becoming tremendous. In the Franco-Prussian War, the French muskets killed more Germans than German, in most all the battles, the Germans lost more heavily than the French, even though the Germans won the war. And that was because musketry had become so effective. So all of the armies were experimenting, and there's a book about the U.S. Army's experiments called Crossing the Deadly Ground, I think. And by 1914, most of them had come to some surprising ideas about tactics. They all thought in terms of firepower and movement. The Germans were very sophisticated. They thought in terms almost continuously of holding somebody in front and trying to get them by a flank attack. So you fire and movement stuff. There are sort of three reasons that this doesn't work in 1914. Why everybody sort of chucks it away, or seems to. There's organizational, there's doctrinal, and there's technological reasons. Technologically, we know we've got all these new weapons, machine gun especially, and of course the magazine rifle, which was astonishingly good weapon. So these could keep up a lot of fire. And you got rapid-fire artillery. You got much faster communications. We tend to look at Napoleon's campaigns and he did this and he did that. Well, if radios had been around, he couldn't have done this and that to a great extent. This is something that in 1914 was possible. Airplanes conducting reconnaissance. Almost literally in the first moments of the war, you have reconnaissance planes spotting troops because there's no concept of camouflage. So the first thing is the technological. Just these weapons were enormously effective. The troops who had experience knew this immediately. And it's worth thinking about several things here. These armies were enormous. The British and the French, to a somewhat lesser extent, had a lot of officers who had seen active service. The Germans had very few. The Austrians had almost none. In fact, most of the armies had almost none, except for a few guys who'd been, maybe on riot duty or something. So it took a while for some of these lessons to filter down. The Gatling gun was the Maxim gun was demonstrated to the Kaiser in about 1890, and he said, "We need this." And it took 8 years before the army bureaucrats adopted it. Meanwhile, in Africa, German officers were dipping into their pockets to buy the damn things because they were so useful. So it took time for the bureaucrats to catch up. But certainly by the Russo-Japanese War, the only difference between the Russo-Japanese War and the First World War is there are no airplanes. I mean, the technology is exactly the same. People understood there was a problem. But it wasn't just technology. The tactics were pretty good, but the numbers were bad. The numbers of the armies were bad. Even the biggest battle ever in history prior to 1914 was Mukden. And it had a couple of 100,000 guys on each side on a front of 90 miles. But it was a front. And arguably, if there had been, you know, if there had been enough troops left, you could have had a flank attack. In 1914, the armies are humongous, and there's no room to maneuver, which is usually forgotten. When the Germans invade Belgium, their army corps are actually not capable of conducting proper operations until they've begun to spread out, because there's not enough frontage, so they're just marching along on roads, which is one of the reasons why the Belgians are able to hold them up for a day or two in a couple of river battles. Now, you just run out of space. Literally, you run out of space. It's almost like a fortress. You've got enough men to cover the front the way you could cover the walls of a fortress. So I forget how many yards, you know, how many men per yard of wall you're supposed to have. The outbreak of the war is another issue. You mobilize. Now, we think of these armies, you know, we think of the German army. We see the films of the Kaiser reviewing his troops, goose-stepping down the Unter den Linden and whatnot. And we see, films of the masses of troops. What we forget is that all of those armies, a huge percentage of the troops, were reservists. And while the guys on active duty, at most, had been on active duty for 2 years, so arguably that's good enough to make a good soldier, but we probably do a better job of training a guy in 2 years today than they did in those days, since we have a better understanding of, you know, how to motivate people and what are the optimal ways of doing things. A lot of tradition still involved in the training of troops back in the good old days there. You know, learning how to fix a uniform that had feathers and stuff. When you bring the reservists in, these reservists are not like National Guardsmen. You know, if you're in the National Guard, every month you have about 5 days of training. And then, of course, over the summer you have about 2 weeks of training. If you're a reservist in the German Army, in your first 8 or 10 years, I forget which it is, you get about 2 weeks refresher training. They don't even have admin time, really. It's mostly just if you move or something, you have to notify your local reserve unit that you're relocating, you know. And then when you went from the first line of the reserve into the second line of the reserve, where you'd be there for another 10 years or so, you got maybe another week's training for the whole. So you got guys who've been out of uniform for 10, 15 years with only a few days training since they last saw service. So that's another problem that occurs, because you can't do sophisticated tactics if you don't have trained troops. If I did my hitch in the active army in, say, 1904, 1905, and I've been a reservist since then, and I'm called up in 1914, well, am I hip to the most recent developments in the army and stuff? So that's part of the problem. All of these armies were also desperately short of officers. It's surprising. The German army had 33,000 regular officers. There were also about 40,000 reserve officers. When the army mobilized, it needed about 120,000 officers. So right there on the first day of the war, the army is short 40,000 officers. And that hits, that's a hit too when you want to, you know, take the troops out. All of these armies begin pulling in retired guys, hastily commissioning people. A lot of British platoons end up being led by guys who'd done university cadet corps service, and then been, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, and are now called up and given a few days refresher and sent into the front. That's not going to help. The British were dipping into the guys who'd retired during the Boer War in order to find officers. So you got troops led by officers who haven't been in the army in 10 years or so, or who just have, who got a one-year, was it Einjahr Freiwilliger, a one-year volunteer, and are now suddenly either senior NCOs or platoon leaders. So this all combines to result in them abandoning the idea of fire and movement. In the case of the French army, they also have the this ideology that starts sweeping through the army of élan vital, just get the troops real hepped up and then just go in with the bayonet and you'll take the casualties, but it'll all be over real quick, and it's better than a long war. Supposedly Foch did this. Actually, Foch was the fire and movement guy, and that's one of the reasons why Foch's troops tended to do better than other people's troops, because he still kept the idea of the fire in. Even the Germans abandoned frontal, their sophisticated tactics, and you have incidents. I guess the largest battle involving cavalry on the Western Front was an action called, it was along the Gette River. The Belgian cavalry encountered the German cavalry advancing at the Gette River, which is in the center of Belgium, a little somewhat east of Brussels. And the Germans went in, with lances. The Belgians got off their horses and started shooting at them. Held the German army up for about a day. It also, inflicted severe harm on the German cavalry corps. They just threw out the doctrine. They wanted to go in and get it done. I don't know how you can, get into their heads, but they thought they were doing the right thing, which is amazing. British did better, at least in 1914, because they were primarily on the defensive the whole time. The British role in the Battle of the Marne was basically to advance into the empty space that the French had, that the Germans had opened up, because they were encountering French counterattacks on the left and right of the seam between the first and second armies. So the British were excellent in defensive stuff, which, the Germans thought that they were encountering machine gun companies when it was just Brits with the Lee Enfield, well-trained Brits with the Lee Enfield. Although many of the Brits were reservists, at least they knew how to use their rifles. So that was one of the problems with the tactics of the time. There were others, the French, with the red pants and blue jackets and red caps for enlisted men and white caps for officers didn't help. But all the armies also mostly went into battle carrying flags, which we tend to forget now, except the British. The British had begun to leave theirs behind. That they begin to improvise. In part, it's the troops. The troops begin to go to ground, especially once the movement, the war of movement stops. The heaviest fighting, in fact, the heaviest casualties in the war are during the war of movement. We think of the Somme and Passchendaele and those other battles. Notice, by the way, that those are both Brit battles, because we're so into the Brit side of the war. The French army, the heaviest casualties in the history of the French army occurred on August 22nd. There was something like 26,000 men killed in one day, which is higher than the British loss on the Somme. And we don't ever hear about that part, you know. Foch lost both his son and his son-in-law on that day. To their credit, the French began to catch on pretty quick. But since they were on the offensive, that was a problem. The improvisation of defenses began during the Battle of the Marne, people digging in. You don't have barbed wire yet, but if you can find any kind of ground, you can dig in on it. The Germans, having been thrown back, you know, from the Somme, from the Marne, get to the Aisne, and the last chance of achieving a victory by maneuver probably ended then. There might have been one or two opportunities otherwise. And that is also attributed to organization. Although the German army supposedly worshipped at the altar of Moltke, there was an excessive rigidity from the top down. And there were several occasions during the campaign when junior commanders, like corps commanders and whatnot, you know, spotted opportunities and, you know, inquired from headquarters, you know, listen, this French corps has just exposed its flank. Can I hit it? You know, and down from headquarters would come no keep to the timetable. Well, you know, that didn't help. You had an army that had a plan, and unlike the German army in 1870 or the German army in the Second World War, had not devolved to decision making downwards. So that also tended to create the log jam at the front. In contrast to the French, where a lot of initiative was given. Which was in part caused the problem, since guys were attacking before they were supposed to. I mean, the French plan was that the Germans would, you know, the Germans would reveal their hand by undertaking offensives, presumably in Alsace, and then once the Germans start attacking, we can counterattack into their attack. And unfortunately, most of the French generals decided they just attack. But you get guys who begin to see opportunities. General Lannrezac, in the French Fifth Army, although he's just supposed to be covering the flank, realizes that the Germans are coming across in much greater strength into Belgium than the army had believed, and figures that the best way to do something about this is to undertake an attack, because it will draw attention, it'll impede the Germans and draw attention from the high command. It did, of course. Lannrezac got sacked. But Joffre did notice the problem, so he began to juggle troops from his right flank to his left flank. As the war goes on, this unevenness in understanding doctrine that had caused everybody to chuck out the rule book in the beginning of the war continues. And while frequently you get new ideas, they don't percolate through the ranks very well. Very interesting book came out about 3 or 4 years ago on the Battle of the Somme. These two British historians went to the battalion documents and managed to find the attack plans of a large percentage of the British battalions that were involved in the action. And some of them, you know, we have this image of the Brits going forward, you know, head down, shoulders squared, bayonet fixed, and just marching forward stoically into the German machine guns. Well, there were some units that basically told their troops to do that. But there were other units that were doing other stuff. There were a couple of battalions that had actually infiltrated into no man's land on the eve of the attack. And their jumping off point was on the Germans, you know, on the edge of the German wire. So they didn't have to clear their own wire and then, you know, and in some cases they had actually they were the most successful units, but of course everybody else was doing something stupid, and there's no follow-up, and they couldn't move the reserves anyway because the place was a mud heap to begin with. By resorting to new technology, they had all sorts of crazy ideas. And we look back and we say, it's a crazy idea. But it wasn't necessarily a crazy idea in 1914 or 15 or 16. I mean, the tank was a crazy idea. And there were plenty of people who didn't think the tank was going to work. There were plenty of people who thought helmets were useless when they began to issue helmets. Some generals reported that helmets had caused an increase in deaths from head injuries. Well, actually, what was happening was that guys who had disabling head wounds that would leave them paralyzed or something before the... No, I'm sorry, the reverse. An increase in head wounds. What happened, of course, was that a guy who got hit in the head before the helmet died. A guy who got hit in the head with a helmet would probably live. But now he's counted as a wounded guy instead of a dead guy, so there's an increase in head wounds. I mean, it sounds funny, but... they began to do what worked. And it frequently was painful. We tend to forget that it wasn't the casualties that bothered people as much as the lack of success. British casualties during the so-called 100 days, the last 3 months of the war, when the British Army really shined. I mean, it was combined arms tactics, infantry armor and air support working together. But the German defensive tactics were very good, and British casualties during the 100 days were about the same as British casualties at Passchendaele, except that, you know, Passchendaele was like, they advanced, what, 3 miles in 6 months or something like that? And in 1918, they advanced a couple of hundred miles, and it kicked the Germans almost entirely out of Belgium and out of a major chunk of France with the Americans and French. We actually didn't do as much in the war as we like to think we did. And General Pershing's idea about open field combat was probably a disaster because the troops first had to get through the trenches before they could figure out how to do open field combat. And our training program reversed the two. So you had divisions going into action because of the rush to get to the front in the last weeks of the war. You had divisions going into action who actually had been fairly well trained in open field combat, but had not yet gone through the cycle of trench training. You know, how to clear a trench, which was not very good. By the end of the war, they have a pretty good idea of how to do these things. They've adopted all sorts of new weapons, the hand grenade, which actually was an ancient weapon that had been revived by the Russians and Japanese during the Russo-Japanese War. They used to improvise them. And it took a while for people to get the idea that the hand grenade was like the infantry's artillery. You know, an infantryman could attack with a sack full of hand grenades as effectively as he might be able to attack with his rifle, because he could just keep chucking hand grenades at the enemy, and if someone was covering him, they could advance, fire and movement kind of thing. And that was the joke, was the French just needed hand grenades and bayonets by the end of the war. But that's how this sort of developed. The other one was they revived ancient tactics here. We tend to think of trenches as a World War I phenomenon and forget that there had been experiences in the past in our own history. The Petersburg lines extended some, what, 20, 30 miles? You know, more than that, I think, around Richmond down through Petersburg. And there had been cases in the Napoleonic War, when Wellington did the lines of Torres Vedras, where he basically, he knows he's going to have to retreat into Portugal because the French are just in enormous numbers, and So he has a line fortified that covers Lisbon, and in such a way that the flank can't be turned because it's on the Tagus estuary on the one side, and on the other side it's on the Atlantic coast. And he just has this system of trenches and fortresses and bastions and whatnot that extends, 100-odd miles. If you look at some of these defensive systems, it's amazing how much they look like the defensive lines that are established in 1914. And you go back to Caesar, and if you ever read anything about Caesar, you get this wonderful lesson in the lines of Alesia. And he's got pointy stakes on the ground instead of barbed wire, and he's got ditches and so on and so on, and successive lines, and all these guys had read that stuff. So the beginning of fortification in many cases was just people improvising on the basis of these ancient ideas. And then, of course, barbed wire, which the Russians had made an extensive use of in 1904, and the Spanish in their wars in Cuba. Spanish had actually built two barbed wire fences across all of Cuba, one on each side, in order to contain the rebels who happened to be most strong in the eastern and western ends of the island, and it was very successful. So you still have generals who aren't bright. Douglas Haig wasn't as stupid as he's sometimes portrayed, and he didn't live in a chateau. He lived in a rather pleasant little house, but it wasn't a chateau. And his staff officers did visit the front, but there was... he just had this fondness for doing things the old-fashioned way and kept the cavalry around much too long, although the cavalry finally did do some good work in 1918, which is usually ignored, but it wasn't worth the cost of maintaining several cavalry divisions, four cavalry divisions for most of the war on the Western Front, since the cavalry division consumed more resources than an infantry division, which had about three times the manpower. And some of the French guys were still gung-ho for attacks, which sometimes succeeded. If you could get close enough before you made your attack, it would sometimes succeed. And that was why the Germans began abandoning the front. They would establish outpost lines rather than have a continuous front, sort of forward of the main line of resistance. You'd have this series of outpost lines, and they would have to be overcome, since you'd have interlocking machine gun nests and whatnot as you advanced. And the artillery was not likely to get them all, especially since the Germans were very good at ditching. So you could saturate it with artillery and still not necessarily get all the strong points. And it only took a few strong points to hold up the advance in a particular sector. And then, of course, comes the tank. And I'm going to leave it to Austin now, because he's the tank guy.
Austin, Mr. Tank Guy, tell us about the tank.
Well, Dan, let me pick up on a few things else.
All right.
That's a fascinating, they're intimate view in places and a great overview, Al. But Al mentioned the importance of the magazine rifle. Look, that 1903 30-06 Springfield, which was a U.S. standard rifle, 5 rounds in it, that's still a good rifle, Dan.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, it's a good, you put a scope on it, and you've got an outstanding sniper rifle. As a matter of fact, it was used as a sniper rifle in World War II, showed up in Korea, and could still be used now. We use its, its grandson is a version of the M14 as a sniper rifle. It's shown back up in platoons, Afghanistan, because you need to reach. And you'll still see a Taliban using their knockoff Lee Enfield 303s, manufactured in, well, probably in Pakistan, but they're, because they've got range and firepower. Now, just to take, before I even get into machine guns, Al talked about from the channel to Switzerland or the sea to Switzerland. That's another way you'll hear it. You've got a before we get the machine guns, you've got millions of men with rifles with magazines and can shoot five rounds pretty darn fast. I'm even getting into artillery yet, Dan. That's a lot of firepower going straight on at one another. And the infields and Springfields and German Mausers of that type, they are effective, certainly out to 300, 400 meters, but you can hit targets with them. This is why they still use the sniper rifles, 600 to 800 meters, effectively a good shot. And the round, of course, will go further. But you'll see in World War II, using the Springfield, the American snipers were to engage 600 to 800 meters with their longer shot if you could. That's still a long shot. Yes, yards in World War II for Americans, mm-hmm. but that thing, the same. Concept in it. So you've got depth with reach, and then with your standard infantry weapon of the time. Now, start adding machine guns, and machine guns aren't new because you have Gatling guns in the Civil War. As a matter of fact, I was reading a Civil War history about 3 weeks ago, and it included a comment from a Northern Union critic that Grant didn't use enough machine guns. Didn't call them machine guns. He called these rapid fire Gatlings, and it was when he could have, he didn't understand them or whatever. But that could have been immediate look back. Al was talking about the personal histories published right after World War I. You had some of the same kind of bitter remonstrances published 1865, 1866, very, very quickly on this. Why didn't you use that weapon? Well, the Gatling gun was actually much improved by 1875 over the 1865. There had been some changes in that, but nevertheless, we'd had rapid fire and fairly effective ones for certainly the last 30 years of the 19th century. And the Maxim gun is quite good. People understood what machine guns could do to a degree, and certainly the tacticians and operational leaders wanted them in the early part of the 20th century, late part of the 19th century. You had very effective use of machine guns in the Mexican Revolution, as an example. As a matter of that famous recruiting poster from Pancho Villa, he wants machine gunners and railroaders. That's understood what machine guns could do, and they were quite effective. As a matter of fact, Al's actually written about this, as I recall, about some of the defensive positions in place by some of the Mexican Revolutionary forces that had a kind of a World War I strong point look to them, with barbed wire, concrete, sandbags. Because of the increasing of effectiveness of light artillery, lighter artillery, you could move it around and machine guns. But that said, look at some of the Union and Confederate positions around Petersburg in 1865, certainly, after all the heavy shelling and fighting around Petersburg, and you tell me that looks substantially different from World War I, 1915, 1916. It really doesn't. Firepower had already, Dan, had already, had increased firepower, had already wreaked huge effects and massive casualties on forces in close combat in the American Civil War. Now, 1914, we've got everybody's got a rifle with a magazine in it, if not a automatic pistol. You've got much more effective, I'll even call them modern machine guns with Maxim. How they are organized, there's some question about this. I mean, the British were still having machine gunners wanted to have their own corps. And we're talking about what we would now call medium or heavy machine guns, but there was even some debate over what that Lewis gun was. Now, Lewis gun was probably better call it an automatic rifle, but that thing had light machine gun-like characteristics. There was some debate about ultimately World War II. Remember, it was a World War I design, the Browning automatic rifle, the BAR. Is it a light machine gun or an automatic rifle? 20-round magazine, maybe it's an AR, but it certainly had kind of... There's something in there, and there are certain types within the military. Well, how do we use this weapon? Is it unique, and should we have these people specially trained, and they're specialist and specially controlled? There was even discussions about use of grenades at grenadiers. Are you a designated grenadier? Ultimately what happens, because as Al says, the lower echelons figure out, hey, anybody who knows how to toss something can throw a grenade, and it's artillery. So, and same thing with machine guns. The British, eventually the Lewis guns are certainly there, integrated within the British platoons. The section, they have a Lewis gun section, and that's the way we've got it now in a modern American platoon. Certainly in the German infantry platoons, Wehrmacht infantry platoons of World War II were machine gun platoons. For the most part, they're built around light machine guns. But starting in 1914, even though the technology is there, and there are some people that have a better grip on how it should be organized, as Al says, you've got these huge armies that are very uneven in their military leadership and their military experience and the soldier training. You've got this technology that is increasing firepower in massive numbers of troops. Now, we talked about this earlier. I won't go into it. The Germans could use railroads up to where the end of the railhead. Most of the Germans in the Great March are doing that on foot through August 1914. But you still had the ability compared to... let's say, certainly pre-1860, but after the American Civil War, after what the Franco-Prussian War, you can see how railroads can bring your manpower reserves from deep inside your country, at least up to the front, if not further. And then you've also got rail repair crews because of the logistics capability. It's not just bringing the manpower, but bringing the food to feed them and the ammunition. And then the heavier weapons, and trying to move heavier weapons along with up to with the forces. So that gets us back down to sea to Switzerland. Suddenly, at least on the Western Front, all of this compresses between. It's still a good piece of territory, but as Al pointed out, there'd been other long defensive systems. If you think about the Chinese, rather successful with a Great Wall of China. Now that was not manned. By any means, they had bastions all along, but it certainly was built. It's not something new that people could take on and try to seal off large, defensively seal off large lengths of front. So, but what happens here is now that you've got not just large lengths of front, but the manpower go in there with it and an increase in firepower. Now, I've talked a little bit about length. I've talked a little bit about depth, Dan, from, hey, out 400 or 500 meters, I'm deadly with my rifles and a little further with my machine guns. You got that. But 1910. Now, I wrote a little bit about this in that biography I did of Kemal Ataturk because he attended it. He and the Turkish military attaché to France. In 1910, the French army had their Picardy exercises, and they integrated aircraft into the exercise. It was huge, a big deal. They had contingents from officer contingents from all over the world, including Japan, show up because they wanted to see what the French were going to do. And the French were experimenting with aerial reconnaissance, not just to find out where opposition was, but come back and start using it as a means of directing indirect fire. That's that they're not doing that per se, but the concept is there. In other words, now you've extended visual capability, and with with providing longer range artillery fire. Now you've added depth to this front, and the eyes are up. We'd had observation balloons before. That's Civil War. Mm-hmm. Everybody had an observation balloons, but now remember those are tethered, very limited on this. With aircraft, they're moving, and they can go deep. You can figure out things that are way behind you. We had telephones, all right, but the thing is you're also starting to get radios, and with radios you can do what? They're kind of bulky as the war starts. It's hard to get one on an airplane, but by darn, they're able to do that. Now you've got a really useful reconnaissance and flexible reconnaissance platform, and it takes a while. But look, 1910, the French test it. 1911, September 1911, the Italians invade Libya. They're going to try to knock off Tripolitania and Cyrenaica, the Ottoman provinces of modern Libya. And they start using aerial reconnaissance to watch the Arab irregulars that the Turks are operating out in the Sahara Desert, but also use them as strike platforms. Very primitive, border-like bombs and grenades, and throwing them outside. But they're airstrikes. And they even had some small dirigible balloons conducting airstrikes. So you have that 1911, 1912, and we're just a step from 1914. There were foreign officers, observers out looking at what the Italians were doing. The French were out there. The Germans were out there. British were all out there. What are these guys doing with these aircrafts? Well, again, what am I saying here? Depth and knowledge, and it translates to, at least in tactically and operationally on the Western Front. This has gone on a while. We'll get back to the Eastern Front and some of the other places later, and the Balkans and the like. But what translates on the Western Front is that you've got reconnaissance capabilities, observational capabilities, communication capabilities on this knocked-in sector between Switzerland and the Atlantic Ocean to know where somebody's building up forces. Now, you can still be surprised. There's still surprise attacks carried out, but you've got a better notion of where the other guy's going to try to make a punch. And you can do what? Anticipate. Move troops, prepared defenses in depth. And the Germans, let me move to the next thing I was going to talk about. Al talked about the defensive positions. Soldiers figure it out first. Well, they go to ground. They learn how to dig. But then let's go on reverse slope defense. One of the things that made the German defenses so tough for the French and Brits to crack is that they went into deeply bunkered reverse slope positions on some of the, taking advantage of some of the geography on the territory that they'd overrun in Belgium and France, and it made it harder to hit, and harder to hit with artillery. And of course, what do I mean by reverse slope? Over the crest of a rise, you're defending on the reverse on the reverse of it, and then you can counterattack out of that. The Germans took great advantage of the terrain. So the other thing that I'll add here is that when I said that, how do you integrate the weapons? Let's talk about artillery. Now, rapid-fire artillery had the French 75 was already a known beast. It had an improved carriage, so you didn't have to relay the gun every time. You could fire much fixed ammunition, and so it's not a machine gun, but by darn, it's a heck of a lot faster. The artillery's a lot faster than the old muzzle loading cannon. And there's also improvements in powder. There are improvements in the way that the munitions are constructed in terms of being able to outlay explosion or penetrate or even where, you know, whether it's a point detonation or whether the the round can go into the mud before it blows up. So that you've got those technical elements that are not well understood by the military. All their science guys and their technical specialists, their engineers, and a few of the developmental people who oftentimes have first access, Dan, to the news media of the time, saying, well, these idiots didn't know how to do it. Well, they're trying to survive, and they have you told them about how these weapons work? But the artillery integration, one of the things they experiment with is rolling barrages, because you could see that the barrage out in front of the advancing infantry would tear up barbed wire, suppress enemy positions. But that's really tough to control, Dan, because if the rounds fall short, and rounds always fall short, you hit your own people, you know, friendly fire. There's no such thing as friendly fire, but that's the term for it, of course. well, there isn't, Al, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be, you know, there's a, how do you control it? And the thing is, if you try to use it by wire, by telephone wire, one thing, telephone wire gets trampled on, cut, broken, enemy counterfire, and the like. If you use an intense barrage, and there are barrages that would go on for days, weeks, and just expend massive amounts of artillery ammunition, oh, that's a tip off to the other guy that you're gonna strike. And if you try for surprise, no barrage, and this is one of the experiments, is the other guy's sitting there, and sometimes this would work, especially with, as Al said, infiltration. And some of this went on 1915 and 1916. Mm-hmm. This wasn't invented by the Germans in 1918. Mm-hmm. The infantrymen are anything but stupid. We sneak up there. We get an advanced position. We figure out where the I'm doing this. Let's say I'm using a British example because I've studied the British tactical responses and German more than I have the French. But look, one reason Field Marshal Foch was the field marshal and chosen as a combined commander was because he was open. He was very open-minded to many of these doctrinal experiments and changes. Al mentioned him earlier. He was to get back to my example, we infiltrate essentially assault teams, and they wouldn't use that that term. One of the British terms for it was the blob. They would use a blob. The thing in a blob would have grenadiers, riflemen, and grenadiers would be guys carrying more grenades. They might be carrying a pistol instead of taking a rifle with them, but that would depend on the immediate tactical situation. And when they had Lewis guns, they did Lewis guns positioned within these groups. So you sneak out at night, you try to overrun or occupy, take out German observation trenches or forward observation posts or whatever in no man's land, cut through where you can do it without giving away what you're up to, obstacles, and prep it, and then creep forward with your assault force. And then you're not going to barrage because the barrage is going to tip off the Germans. You're going to take that first trench. Then if you've taken that first trench, you get the back, you've already registered your guns. Your guns fire to suppress the Germans because the Germans are going to try to launch a counterattack. And now you're moving other forces up because the Germans don't have those forward machine gun positions. And you're bringing in the next assault wave of infantry, which is finally going to break through that second and third trench line and then get back beyond those German bunkers. Is that insane? No, actually, it's not. It's not insane. It's an attempt to punch through. It's a penetration attack, but attempt to achieve surprise, and it involves infiltration, which is a kind of maneuver in very restricted circumstances. And there was a lot of intellectual discussion and experimentation at the battalion, brigade, division levels. You can see this by 1916. There are a couple of good studies that take advantage of this, where the historians have gone and looked at all of the pamphleteering by the British and French officers, where some of these ideas, they'd be printed up for divisions, sometimes for corps. And there are a few of them that actually, at least in the British Army, were distributed army-wide. Here's what we did in this division, and this has had this success, and you would have officers who would resist it and officers who would say, hey, let's adapt that. So there was not some rigid, you know, let's just keep marching and doing what we've been doing and being stupid. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of guys, and you can see this with all these pamphlets, because they understood what they were up against, and they weren't going to try to commit suicide. What happens though after 1917, and then certainly in 1918 and 100 days, is that some of this has been figured out. The Germans do, so to speak, shoot their wad with the Kaiser's offensive in 1918. They're weaker, but the Allies also have figured out how to better integrate these weapons. And it's the thing to take away out of this is that neither Al nor Austin think that everybody was stupid and everything was lined up, everybody shooting at each other out of trenches. That wasn't what was going on. There was certainly a lot of wasted manpower and wasted lives. There's no question about that. But at the same time, there was a lot of thinking and experimentation of how do we do this better. I'll add one other thing, too. Trench mortars. Trench mortar, extremely effective weapon.
But also invented by the troops.
Yeah, basically. Well, the Stokes mortar, which is really still basically our modern British and American mortars are highly improved. There were two types of Stokes mortars, but on the one that was adopted, it essentially was a 3-inch mortar, which is, dare we say it, an 81-millimeter mortar. But how do you use them? Troops figured out very quickly they're mobile artillery. My goodness, and plus you can drop a good mortar crew can drop around. Even now we can do it with smart rounds, but drop around right on the lip of a trench, if not in it. And you don't have to get a guy up there with a grenade to do it. The mortar grenade or the mortar bomb is taking care of it for you. Now, remember, the mortars were not a new idea. You have Civil War mortars, and the British Army had mortars, these big, huge things with high-angle fire to hit at forts. But these are light, mobile infantry mortars. And same doctrine debate went through, well, should these be controlled by, you know, higher units? Well, no, they actually need their infantry support weapons. Maybe you don't put them in an infantry platoon, but you put them in a mortar platoon. This is the way it ultimately evolved, and it reflected the actual usage of the weapon system, so that the company commander or the platoon leaders or the platoon sergeants can take advantage of that weapon. And this has worked out in World War I, Dan, but it's worked out at a lot of loss of lives, but very tremendous little weapon system. And that's why we still use mortars, and everybody in some way or another that's ever had a infantry tactical problem, basically a rifle grenade is an attempt to substitute for a mortar. I say that rifle grenades also became a reality in World War I, and that was to try to give the infantry a cheap indirect fire capability.
The rifle grenade, you know, was invented in the 17th century.
Oh, I know. I'm aware. Yeah. I'm aware
and,
of that.
And there are examples. You know, surviving examples look exactly like the improvised stuff
from
that the guys are starting to use in World War One. Yeah.
No. I'm aware of that. Yeah. Now, the thing is, though, is that what comes out of it is in World War One, you actually have rifle grenades made for employment, but it has to come out. It comes out of the hey, we need this weapon, and it's the submachine gun. The Germans actually field in 1918. A real submachine gun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a little drum weapon. I think it was 9mm. I'm forgetting the name of it. You know what? It starts with a B.
Yeah.
Our listeners will know this right off the top of their heads. It's because you needed something close in, trench work, and there were guys that were experimenting with making big, long magazines on semi-automatic pistols, and also, you know, the Germans with their pistols and developing, you know, a machine pistol, because that's really what you needed to clean out a trench or clean out a bunker.
Mm-hmm.
That's a World War One.
Several armies were experimenting with that, and of course,
The Italians experimented with one, but as I recall, their original submachine gun, they were going to put it on an airplane, weren't they?
I think that's right.
But
light machine gun, intended for air.
Yep. Yeah.
But there are quite a number of them. Remember, Browning is doing his work in 1916 and 1917. If the war had lasted a few weeks longer, we might have gotten, the BAR is 1918. Right?
Well, I think that he's got the design.
Yeah.
It's not fielded. The M1919 30 caliber machine gun is our standard World War II era platoon machine gun, but this is M1919, and I'm going to get killed on this because I'm such an M2HB fan, Ma Deuce, but it's 1921. However, he's experimenting with it with the 50 caliber as an anti-tank weapon, anti-armor weapon for World War One. I'm talking about Browning. And, Dan, I know that we've run long on this, but this is a way to end it. Al, there's this kind of a inside joke about Austin's respect for the Ma Deuce, M2 heavy barrel, M2HB. And it's I do have a lot of respect for it. It's a tank commander's weapon, and I've learned to shoot it and also its offspring, the M85, which was a version that set in a little cupola on the M60 series tank, actually. Yeah. it would have them, but that weapon is really a World War One quote unquote era weapon.
Yeah.
And it's still, there's no finer heavy machine gun, and it is still a weapon of choice right now, Afghanistan, Iraq, and if you can get a Ma Deuce, now you've got a weapon that is just good. You know, it's not going to take on tanks, but it's good for everything. It's good for anti-aircraft and the like, and it is a World War One weapon. But it doesn't make combat in World War One. It's typed in, and I think it's 1921. So
yeah, actually, his 1917 machine gun begins to get to the troops.
That's true. That's true.
Late in the war.
That's Browning. That is a 30 caliber machine gun. But I'm talking about the M1919, which is the one that you see in all the World War II movies.
Oh, yeah.
But the one that goes through all kinds of derivatives, M1919A4, M1919A6, which was usually an airborne weapon in World War II. Hey, well, this is too much, Dan. But
yep.
All right.
Well, let's wrap it up there. And
I was going to talk about airplanes a little bit more, but that's okay.
Well, we'll
need to catch up on our tanks and our airplanes next time.
All right.
So
take care, guys.
All right. Take care. Have a good day.
Bye.